I'm Paul Davis, a graduate of Effingham High School, class of 56. I worked at WCRA through high school and part of college. My mom was Zona B. Davis. She called the station during the hospital fire of 1949 and said the radio station needed to help people find their loved ones. The station folks said, "We don't know how to do that. Would you do it?" She said, "Okay," and she retired 30 years later. I'm reading what she wrote about the hospital fire, entitled "Greater Love Hath No Man." It was the midnight of April 4th, 1949. The 8,000 people of our little town had gone home from their club meetings, parent-teacher conferences, church gatherings, drive-ins, lessons and toys, and mending and small talk that had been put aside, and lights were out. Suddenly, the night was cut with the blast of a fire siren, streaming at top key, insistent, desperate. The volunteer firemen left their beds instantly. Then all the people left their beds. Left them because the fire siren would not still, joined by the moan of ambulances through the streets. The sky over the city turned pink, and other sirens in thin wails were sounding from everywhere, weaving a weird medley that chilled the heart and bound the lungs. And there was horror and deep sorrow in Effingham, Illinois, that night. St. Anthony Hospital flamed in the sky like a giant torch. The hospital, operated by the Sisters of the Order of St. Francis, was a 120-bed institution. There were 128 patients, visitors, and employees there on the fatal night. Of that number, 74 perished. The fire was instantaneous. No one yet knows how it started or what caused it to spread in long, parallel streaks that flooded the entire hospital in a flash, from basement to the third floor. One moment it was a thin wisp of smoke in a clothes chute, like a cigarette burning. 10 minutes later, there was nothing alive within the hospital. With masses of others quickly gathered, I knew frustrating helplessness, as heat beat us back like a mill furnace. People screaming, leaping from windows. Some tried to drag their broken bones across the lawn away from the fire. Some struck the ground and did not move. As flames roared hungrily through the 80-year-old institution, the ground surrounding it seethed in confusion. Within the hospital, in that small space of minutes, even seconds, decisions were made that forever affected the lives of hundreds of people, and in that 10 minutes were born deeds of love and heroism that exemplified the love of God. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Miss Louise Dieters, a nurse who was asleep in the nurse's house, a short distance from the hospital, recalled a little later, "I was awakened about midnight by the most tortured screams I'd ever heard. Throwing on a coat, I called the other nurses, telling them there was a fire. We ran to the hospital, which was silhouetted in brilliance. Flames tumbled through the corridors as if they were flues, and window panes snapped and shattered. We couldn't enter the building, so we quickly dragged mattresses from the storeroom just back of the hospital. As we spread them on the ground, the firemen shouted to the patients to jump, but while they spoke, the screaming stopped, and the victims slipped from view, choked with smoke and overcome with the yellow-red claws of fire. The sobs and cries of the helpless and anguished mingled with the sounds of heavy streams of water streaking into the inferno that suddenly was quiet, quiet, as I stood shaking, petrified, non-believing. Doctors arrived with emergency kits, but there wasn't enough morphine to kill the pain, pain like that of a battlefield. Some of the injured were carried to nearby houses, some to storage rooms, some to the barn back of the hospital. Relatives and friends and curious onlookers tangled together like roots of a willow, pushing desperately, frantically, trying to find their loved ones. Ambulances wedged through the clogged streets, blocked by other ambulances with vibrating sirens, anxious to be gone, fighting to get through the throngs of people, people with one desperate question on their lips, on their faces, the question, "Where is my loved one? In a house? Taken to a hospital? In the flames? Heaven help! Who knows?" Radio station WCRA in Effingham became a clearinghouse of information. As news director of the station, I had the task of helping find all who lived, identifying all who died. With that assignment, I walked where many didn't, witnessed much, heard much. And many times as I worked, I whispered the word spoken by Christ, "Greater love hath no man." There was a little family or colony of oldsters on the third floor of the hospital, and they shared each other's lives much as families do. One of them was blind John Kabilski, who came to the United States from Russia when he was a young man in quest of excitement and better living. He found excitement in the form of tragedy, for he lost his eyes in a mine disaster. He had lived in the hospital more than 25 years, and he made brooms in the basement. Though sightless, blind John could sweep as well as anyone, measuring the floor with his steps, and he knew all the doors and corridors of the hospital. Night was the same as day to blind John. He could easily have found the elevator down when he heard the shouts of fire, but he could also find his frightened bedbound buddies, and they needed him. Forsake them, not blind John. His pal was Big Dan Lovett, the old gardener. Big Dan was a mule and a horse buyer living in the village of Totopolis in his younger days. He had resided in the hospital for a number of years. His friendship was highly valued on third floor, as he was willing to help whenever needed. He had two extra beds put in his room just in case there was no room elsewhere for a needy patient. He picked up the old people who fell out of their beds. He helped the paralytics move to a better position, and he brought cold water to the invalids who could not help themselves. Big Dan might have saved his life, but could a man leave his helpless friends? Emma Mussman was an important member of the top deck family. Emma sat much of her day on a stool, knitting and operating the elevator, bringing visitors to the top floor dwellers. She also did small hand washings for the more helpless members of the group, and with the small remunerations received, she bought plain handkerchiefs. On these, she crocheted edgings, then donated them to the hospital bazaar. Emma might have escaped, but how could she ride that elevator on its last trip down and leave the others to die? She was strong and tall. Maybe they could all escape if she helped. Everyone who got on the elevator on that last trip down would probably have been saved. A male nurse on third floor called to them to come quickly. There was a serious fire. He was going down. He escaped with minor injuries. The others chose to stay. Greater love hath no man. In charge of the nursery on the second floor was a 22-year-old nurse, Fern Riley, a brown-haired girl, the third of 10 children. She was a person determined to do her best in all things, such as that her school yearbook carried a short poem under her picture, which read, "Gun no kill, fire no burn, big strong girl, call her Fern." There were 10 newborn babies on the second floor nursery. As the flames licked hungry tongues into the room, Fern looked from the window to the fire-lighted lawn below. To throw the babies to the ground would be to dash them to death. In the seconds she waited for help, the fire spread over the hospital as lightning suddenly strikes the sky. She could have jumped even then, but a nurse who escaped heard her cry of decision, "My babies! I've got to stay with my babies." She died with her tiny wards as she threw herself as a shield between the flames and the row of bassinets. It was the last night of private duty for Mrs. Hillary Clemente, 21, mother of a 9-month-old daughter. Her husband urged her to stay at home that night, reminding her that she needed the rest and that her patient was doing well enough to get along without a private nurse. Mrs. Clements hesitated, wanted to stay with her family. Then, remembering her vows as a nurse, she kissed them goodbye. Mrs. Clements, critically burned, was found that night on the hospital grounds and carried to a nearby house. Mrs. Thurman Davis, who lived near the hospital, was pouring olive oil onto her burned body when Mrs. Clements said calmly, "Don't bother with me. I can't live. I know my nerve endings are burned. Help someone else." And she was left to await the stretcher bearer. Mrs. Clements died 2 days later in a Granite City hospital, where she was taken by ambulance that night. Calm in the hour of confusion were two old fellows, 82-year-old Charles Wishard and his friend Fred Carver, age 74. They shared room 137. No one knows how they managed to get out. But as the siren sounded, the 82-year-old man was pulling the 75-year-old cripple along the east side of the building. The cripple stumbled, and despite the heat, the old friend helped him up, and the two, barefooted, in their nightshirts, stumbled onto safety, helping each other. Mrs. Elizabeth Althoff was a patient in the hospital. Her nurse tried to lift her, to help her from the bed and to the window. Mrs. Althoff realized it would not be easy, and she said, "Go on, "You're young and can do something. Don't worry about me. I'm old." As the nurse fled the room, she heard Mrs. Althoff saying, "Dear Jesus, have mercy. Jesus, have mercy." Hospital engineer Frank Reese could have escaped. He was called by a sister when she noticed smoke in the clothing chute. When he looked down the chute seconds later, it was belching flames. He shouted to this sister to close all the doors and dashed to another floor. His body, keys in hand, were recovered from the ruins. The Reverend C.O. Sandon, hospital priest, might have lived had he not stopped to pray. When his body was found, he was still in a kneeling position in the smoldering ruins. Firemen forgot the meaning of food or rest. Many of them held the nozzles of a hose for hours without letting up for a moment. Had they let loose of the hose, it would have whipped and gone wild, and there were no reserve firemen. Once they manned that nozzle, they would but keep it until the heaving engine stopped pumping their heavy streams. After the blaze was quenched, they searched through treacherous smoking ruins, the hot bricks burning their feet and hands as they fought their way through snarling masses of tangled metal, hunting the dead, hunting until their shoes burned off their feet, until they were numb with strain and lack of rest, and nauseated with the smell of burned flesh. Beside them walked a nurse, Miss Norma Bursig. Miss Bursig had been employed at the hospital for 8 years. She knew the location of all the rooms, almost to the square foot. It was Norma who aided greatly in identifying the dead, among them her aunt. The charred bodies were separated only by metal bedsprings or debris and were thus recognized as being on the first, second, or third floor. With the weary firemen, she dug through twisted metal and probed through wads of mattresses, huge mounds of steel-basted plaster, while supporting walls of weakened bricks swayed about them. Should one wall have fallen, all would have fallen like a row of dominoes, covering them like ants. Registrar Miss Helen Wiseman, through a marvelous feat of memory, played a dramatic part in the recovery of bodies that few were aware of. It was believed the records were destroyed, and there was little hope of knowing who was in which room. Through concentration, Miss Wiseman was able to recall the name of every patient in every room. The records were found later in a safe under piles of bricks. A check proved her memory had been correct. The bravery of the families, huddled outside the temporary morgue, was almost sacred. As they were admitted by the attending sister to identify their dead, they would break into shocked, hysterical weeping as blankets were pulled back. Each was asked to examine minutely such things as small pans, broken vases, bits of radios, watches, shoes, glasses, and other articles found near the bodies. These things, rather than the remains, identified them. Which was theirs? How could they know? Then one of them spoke. "What does it matter?" she reasoned bravely. "They are no longer living. If you take my child and I take your mother, your son, or your father, these remains will soon return to dust. And who could tell the difference between two spades of earth? It will be the same as if we had our own." Her words seemed to untwine and release a great burden for the sorrowing. Soft, low talk was in agreement with her thinking. What did it really matter? They would never know, but God knew. Finally, the fire trucks clanged slowly away, their soft bells seeming a dirge to those who perished. The morgue was closed, and fresh flowers marked new graves all over the area. On Thursday, April 7th, Memorial Day in the heart of the USA, crowds that had continually thronged the hospital grounds drifted away, leaving a strange quiet resting in the blackened, ragged bricks when I returned that evening. The walls of the crippled structure reached in piteous silhouette in the April twilight. Pigeons circled overhead, flying away to come back and look again, for the disaster had taken their homes too. Sparrows hopped briskly about the lawn, picking up bits of cotton and examining colorful pills on the grass. The wind flapped a piece of tin that had been nailed on a kitchen window, and the soft songs of evening birds wafted across the soggy grounds. Broken shrubbery half-supported window screens, burned lumber, and blackened guttering. Clutching the weaving partitions were twisted bed springs, portions of metal beds that would not let go. Heat registers dangled in the air, suspended by tubes of plumbing still intact on the walls. I walked into the hospital kitchen, located in a corner of the basement, the only spot that had escaped the fire. It looked very much like any kitchen might look if it were left in a hurry. Stacks of dishes, unwashed and dried with scraps of food, oranges and grapefruit ready to cut for breakfast, a case of unbroken eggs, a bit of garbage and coffee grounds on a paper, and on a windowsill was a little lamb, its head bowed in the foliage of an ivy. Outside the door, bluebells and daffodils were crumpled and trodden. A large bed of tulips laid flattened by the wheels of the fire trucks. A stone grotto near the garden was unharmed. The statue of Mary, with hands folded as she bowed in prayer, seemed a benediction. Near the grotto was a bed of newly turned sod, where old Dan, the gardener, had planned to scatter his seed. Perched on a clod was a little mint cup, pink, frilled, mocking. It bore the words, "Happy New Year." Today, 11 years later, I walked on the spot old Dan had dug. I found something did come up, a mighty new hospital built by the offerings and loves of the community, the gifts and sympathy of the world, and the benevolence of the Order of St. Francis. The $4.5 million hospital, 6 stories high, fireproof, offers some of the most modern equipment in the world. It provides services, treatment, and care never before possible in the older institution. On the front lawn grows a tree, planted in earth obtained from every state in the Union, as a reminder that even as they gave to help provide a hospital for the community, so must the hospital and community help others. They did not die in vain, those who perished. They died as does a man for his country, or a mother to bring new life into the world. Greater love hath no man.